From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, halting the spread of the Ebola virus, we talk with journalist Lori Garrett, who just returned from Zaire. She spent time in the capital, Kinshasa, and Kikwi, the center of the epidemic, where the chants of people in mourning filled the air. Garrett visited hospitals, spoke with families of victims, and traced the root of the epidemic. She wrote about earlier Ebola outbreaks in her recent book, The Coming Plague, Newly Emerging Diseases in a World Out of Balance. Also today, pornography and the internet. Commentator Stephen Levy considers the current efforts to regulate the information highway. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Lori Garrett, just returned from 2 weeks in Zaire, covering the Ebola virus. She spent time in the capital, Kinshasa, in Kikwi, the center of the epidemic, and in outlying villages. She visited hospitals and talked with families of victims. Garrett is the author of the book, The Coming Plague, about newly emerging diseases. She's also medical and science writer for the New York newspaper Newsday. In today's edition of Newsday, she traces the root of this latest Ebola outbreak, beginning with the man who is now believed to be the first person infected. The symptoms of Ebola are fever, bloody diarrhea, and hemorrhaging from body orifices. There's no cure and no vaccine. The virus is spread by contact with infected body fluids. This outbreak appears to have been contained.
We saw a dramatic slowdown in the numbers of both new cases and deaths that occurred. In the beginning, the numbers of cases and deaths were quadrupling every 3 days. By the time I left, they'd seen 6 new cases in 8 days. So that's a really radical slowdown. And the people themselves are, you know, possessed of a strong amount of common sense. They took the precautions under serious advisement that were provided to them by the World Health Organization and the international team of scientists there. And you could see radical changes in behavior, and in particular, the kinds of behavior that would put people at risk for transmitting the virus.
How much of the containment of the virus do you think is the result of education and health measures, and how much is a result of something inherent in the virus, that the virus ran its course?
That's a great question, and I'm not sure we're going to know the answer right now. I think there's going to have to be a lot of scientific research there, going around testing for samples in people who never got sick to see, you know, has the virus actually changed genetically over the course of this epidemic. But there certainly is a reason to think at this point it's a combination of the two things you describe. Definitely people change their behavior. Radical change, particularly on the issue of how they handled their dead. It is traditional in that part of the world for people to, the closest family members, particularly the spouse, the surviving spouse, to wash the body of the dead and then to prepare the body in a coffin in proper clothing and so on for burial. And then the funerals are open casket funerals, and it is part of the tradition of saying goodbye to the dead to kiss the cadaver, to touch the cadaver, and so on. And these are not unusual behaviors. This is true all over the world in many different cultures. But when you have a bodily fluid transmissible virus that has a lethality of 90%. These are procedures that are extraordinarily dangerous. And it seemed to me that the populace was really getting the message.
So, Lori, what were the most effective ways of getting the message to people about the virus and about how to take precautions against the spread of it?
Very tough, because we're talking about an area that is called a city by virtue of the fact that there's a huge number of people living there.
You're talking about Kinshasa?
No, Kikwit. The population of Kikwit is estimated to be somewhere between 250,000 and 500,000 people. Nobody really knows for sure because there's no real government and nobody does census anymore in Zaire anywhere. But it is a huge, sprawling village. It has none of the attributes of a city except population density. It has only one paved road, not surprisingly, named Boulevard Mobutu after the president. It has no running water, no electricity, virtually no social services. So it's really crazy to call this place a city in the sense that it had none of the attributes, the positive attributes of a city. And one of the problems that posed for in terms of public education is, you know, nobody's going to be able to turn on the radio or the television to get news. There was no newspaper in Kikwit. There is no basic source of information except what people call bush radio, which is to say the word of mouth, rumor vine. What the international authorities did was to set up immediately both passive and active surveillance teams. The passive surveillance teams were located in the various medical clinics that people might go to if they were sick. And these people would screen, were trained to recognize the symptoms and screen Ebola cases. Once a case was found, to immediately talk to whatever family members came in with that case, get blood tests on these people, and teach them immediately how to protect themselves. The active surveillance teams were going out all over Kikwit and all the nearby villages looking for hidden cases of the disease. And as they went, they would pass out pamphlets that described, that were hastily prepared mimeographed sheets that described the basic ways you could protect yourself against the disease.
In your travels around Zaire, did you see much fear or panic?
Certainly, there was quite a bit of fear and panic and quite a bit of tremendous concern. But over time, I saw the fear kind of get balanced a bit as people began to realize, all right, it's frightening, but there are ways that I can take control of the situation. This isn't just a matter of fate and some evil will be visited upon me. This is something that I can have some control over.
What are some of the ways that the fear expressed itself?
Oh, there were so many things. I am only now beginning in my mind to sort out everything I saw and experienced in the time I was there, all the funerals, all the wakes, all the burial proceedings, all the panic and wailing and so on. The city really rang with the sound of wailing. The tradition there is that when someone dies, the oldest child or surviving spouse will immediately go into a wailing that begins with a shouting in Kigongo, someone has died, someone has died, and then an announcement who it is. My husband has died. He was a good husband. He was a good father. He leaves me with seven children, etc. The chant would then escalate and the attributes of the dead would be described, and one by one other members of the family would join in, neighbors would join in, and the biography of the individual who had just died would be described, but described in screaming, wailing, and a sort of frenetic dancing, and then of course sobbing and crying. And when I first arrived in Kikwit, one could literally just drive around and hear this all over from one neighborhood to another. Well, of course, if you live in the city and you hear from one neighborhood to another this wailing, it has a profound effect on you. It builds a sense of not only anxiety for your own health, but a sense of despair for the community as a whole, a sense that something horrible and terrifying has visited upon the society.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Lori Garrett, author of the book The Coming Plague. She's also a medical and science writer with Newsday. Did you go to any of the hospitals in Zaire?
Certainly. And whatever you have read or heard or visually seen about these facilities cannot possibly capture the essence, how horrible these facilities really are. I have traveled rather extensively in Africa over the years. I've covered AIDS in Africa, in remote villages, and all over East Africa and Southern Africa, and I frankly had never seen a hospital as horrible as Kikwit General Hospital.
Would you describe what it looked like?
It is a single-story set of buildings connected by covered walkways, blue stucco, basically. The floors are concrete. The walls are concrete. There are beds. Most of the beds did not have mattresses. They just had the raw coil springs, which, of course, would not be a pleasant experience to lay upon. Those that did have mattresses had no linens of any kind. There was no running water. Patients that were begging for water could not be given water because there was none. Nobody on the entire medical staff had been paid, in some cases, since 1991, when the National Bank was looted thoroughly by Mobutu and his supporters in the government, and the army went on rebellion and looted Kinshasa and much of the country because they had gone unpaid. Since then, virtually all civil servants have had to resort to other means to survive. And for physicians and nurses, that other means has basically been to take whatever medical supplies did arrive at the hospital and sell them immediately on the black market. So if you were hospitalized at Kikwit General, you had to first, or your family had to on your behalf, find those things that were necessary for your care. If, for example, you had appendicitis, your family had to go out and find some anesthesia, find some antibiotics, find a clean scalpel somewhere, etc., and bring the supplies to the physicians before the surgery could be performed.
You know, the doctors and nurses in the hospital, you said they hadn't gotten paid since probably 1991. They sold the hospital goods on the black market. Did they know what they were doing medically?
Yes, and in fact, the horror of it is that some of these people, particularly the head of the hospital, were incredibly well-trained physicians. The head of the hospital had studied medicine in the United States, and they were very well aware of the dangers of the situation. They were not heartless human beings. On the contrary, they were doing everything they could with virtually no support from the outside world to deal with ongoing medical care and then the epidemic crisis that befell them. But you know, these people worked at tremendous personal risk, and many of them lost their lives. They had no protective gear. They had no gloves. They had no masks. They had nothing to protect them from the virus. And similarly, the Red Cross, all of whom were unpaid volunteers, were the ones who would gather people who were ill and bring them to the hospital and then take the cadavers away for burial. When these people started their tasks, they had no protective clothing whatsoever, and four of them died of Ebola that they got from the bodies that they carried away.
I thought a lot of the doctors and nurses had fled after the outbreak was identified.
Some had, but frankly, the majority were still there and working long, selfless hours.
What precautions did you take before entering the hospital?
None.
None?
Well, you just use common sense. You don't touch things. It's not an airborne virus. There's no reason to be terrified. I understand that a lot of my colleagues, other medical writers and so on, refused assignments to go to the epidemic out of a sense of personal fear. I don't understand that. It's not an airborne virus. It's not an easy virus to catch. You have to actually directly be in contact with contaminated bodily fluids. And if you're smart and you don't touch people, they had a, in fact, there was a new handshake. People no longer were greeting each other in salutation by reaching out and shaking hands. The new Kikwit handshake that everybody quickly adopted was touching elbows. Which hopefully were clothed elbows, to avoid spreading the virus hand to hand. I mean, as long as you didn't share food, you didn't touch people, you didn't touch something that someone who might have been contaminated just touched, you were all right.
Did you speak to any of the sick people, or were they too sick to talk?
Way too sick to talk.
Yeah. Were there things you looked for when watching them? I mean, about the effects of the virus that you had described before but hadn't seen?
The one effect I had never seen before or had described to me before that is quite an amazing symptom is this hiccuping. It sounds humorous, but it was not. As part of the hemorrhagic effect of the virus, their diaphragms would go into uncontrolled paroxysms, and they would start hiccup, and they would spend hours on end just gasping for air. Horrible thing.
Hmm. People must have been afraid to take sick members of the family to the hospital.
Yes, they were. And, I mean, let's face it, if you knew that medical staff in the hospital were dying of Ebola, and you knew that it looked like the epidemic started in the hospital, now, we now know that's not true, but it was certainly amplified into a full societal-level epidemic by the experiences in the hospital, then it was not an irrational response to say, hey, we're not taking them to the hospital. A lot of people, as the epidemic wore on, would take their ailing relatives to the villages, which was how it then spread in many of the villages in the area.
Laura Garrett is my guest. She just got back from about 2 weeks in Zaire covering the Ebola outbreak. She's also the author of the book The Coming Plague and is the medical and science writer for Newsday. Laura, let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Laura Garrett, author of The Coming Plague. She just got back from 2 weeks in Zaire covering the Ebola outbreak. Well, in your assessment, was taking the sick to the hospital a good idea in terms of containing the virus? Or do you think it just made for more misery in the hospital? Doesn't sound like there was a whole lot that the medical staff could do except keep the people quarantined and prevent other people from coming in contact with them.
Well, but those are really important things.
Right.
And
right.
In terms of controlling an epidemic, those were essential. Once the team got on the ground, and in particular Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, a Belgian-based organization, got on the ground, it really became essential to improve the hospital facility and make it the primary place that everybody did come. And they had a huge credibility gap to deal with, of course, in the public mind. But Médecins Sans Frontières was just remarkable. Three people, that's all, three doctors came in, and they took one look at that hospital and said, all right, our task in this epidemic is sanitation and hospital credibility. And they marched right in. They tried to hook up the ancient water system and figured out there was a reason there was no running water. All the pipes were clogged up in a mess. And so they set up a rainwater catch facility with a filtration device. And immediately, within the first day of their arrival, they had running water established for the hospital. They also immediately set up a cordon sanitaire, an actual physical set of barriers to isolate off the ward that called Pavilion Number 3, where the patients were kept that had Ebola. And they set up a triage system in the emergency room to identify any incoming people who might be suspect Ebola cases, bring them into the facility, and then to turn everybody else away. So all other medical care was shut down, and it just became an Ebola center so that they didn't run the risk of people getting contaminated in the hospital who weren't already exposed.
You've actually helped trace the Ebola outbreak to the first person who contracted the virus during this outbreak. Who was it? When did they get it?
Yeah, before I tell you the answer, I first want to make a little aside. Two points I think are real important. One is any names I use, any people I identify, it has been explicitly with their permission. A lot of the press has been using people's names without ever asking them, and a great deal of shame and anger built among a lot of the residents of Kikwit when their photographs were taken without their permission, when film was made of them without their permission, and when their names were used without their permission. So whatever names I use, I had the permission to use these names. The second thing is, anything I say about how this all got started is, of course, based on current state of knowledge. The original epidemic control team pulled out this weekend from Kikwit because it is under control. And now a whole new team of scientists has been brought in. These are people who will be here for a long haul, 3, 4, 5 months, doing field investigation of every single aspect of this epidemic. And it may be that they will discover things that contradict what I'm about to say. But here is the current state of understanding. a farmer by the name of Gaspar Menga lived in Kikwit and had a small plot of maize and a small plot of manioc that he was cultivating about 18 miles outside the city in a rainforest area near the Mwembe River. Every day he would get to this site either by walking or hitching a ride if anybody with a vehicle happened to come by. And there he would cultivate his crops and go into the rainforest, chop down trees and burn them to make charcoal, which he would sell in the city as fuel. Somehow, we assume towards the end of December, Gaspar got exposed to whatever animal it is that normally carries this virus. And when I went and studied this area and talked extensively to members of the animal search team, Dr. Robert Swanepoel from the National Virology Institute in Johannesburg, Dr. Oyeba Timori from the WHO offices in Harare, Zimbabwe, there are several things that are very striking about this site. And it's exciting that this is the first time in any Ebola outbreak we really seem to have a pinpointed possible source site, an ecology, if you will, to study. This is rainforest area. It's right on the edge of the whole periphery around it has been deforested for cultivation. And it is a rainforest that is oddly silent. Most rainforests I've been in, you hear the birds, the monkeys screeching. There's a sense of animal life. This is a rainforest lush in botanical life, but seem almost lifeless in terms of animals. The ants, the mosquitoes, the rats, the bats, and the mice seem to be about it. And all larger mammals have long since been hunted into extinction from the area. That has prompted a large investigation now, a real effort to focus on the rodents.
So the person who first got Ebola in this outbreak worked near this rainforest.
Worked in it.
And he probably came into contact with the animal that carries the virus.
Right.
What else did you find out about how he picked it up? Does anybody know anything about that yet, or is that the big mystery?
Well, there's a very active effort going on in that ecology to find, you know, the missing animals, to find whatever species it is that normally carries this virus. Gaspar came home and on January 6th came down with all the classic symptoms of Ebola, though, of course, nobody knew that's what it was at the time. He was diagnosed as a case of Shigella diarrhea, a bacterial disease that produces bloody diarrhea, one of the symptoms of Ebola. He died on January 13th, and I was shown photographs by the family members of his funeral, which we have published in today's Newsday with their permission. In that picture, it's really pretty hard to look at because Gaspar is in an open coffin. And his family members surround the coffin, grieving it, many of them, as is traditional, cradling his head in their hands or touching his body. And all of those whose hands are in that coffin subsequently died of Ebola.
Lori Garrett is the author of The Coming Plague, and she's the medical and science writer for Newsday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Lori Garrett will be back with us in the second part of our show.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Officials in Zaire have traced the recent outbreak of Ebola to a forest worker who died in January. Coming up, we continue our conversation with journalist Lori Garrett about what scientists are learning from this recent outbreak of the virus. Garrett is the author of The Coming Plague, Newly Emerging Diseases in a World Out of Balance. She just returned from 2 weeks in Zaire. Also, the X-rated section of cyberspace. Should the internet be treated like a bookstore or like the broadcast media when it comes to pornography? Stephen Levy, technology columnist for Newsweek, has some thoughts. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with journalist Lori Garrett. She just got back from 2 weeks in Zaire covering the Ebola epidemic. Garrett wrote about the earlier outbreaks of Ebola in her recent book, The Coming Plague, Newly Emerging Diseases in a World Out of Balance. She writes about science and medicine for the New York newspaper Newsday. In the first part of our show, Garrett talked about how the current epidemic was contained. She traced the spread of the virus from the farmer Gaspar Menga, who is now believed to be the first man killed in this epidemic. Garrett says that tracing the progression of the outbreak gave her some basis for optimism.
It really does look like this virus is so rarely in human beings that it is, from a biological point of view, poorly adapted to humans, which is to say it kills them too fast. It's not in the interest of a virus to instantly kill off its hosts, because then where are you going to go live? If you're a virus, you want a happy home, and you want ideally to be like the AIDS virus, where you will eventually kill your host, but you'll have a happy home to live in and reproduce in for 10 or 12 years, and many opportunities to be spread to other human beings over those 10 or 12 years. Killing your host in 4 or 5 days and making them so sick that they don't get up, walk around, and cough on other people is just not very smart from the point of view of a virus. And it looks like normally in whatever host it resides in, it's relatively harmless. It hit the human race and bam, it's a killer. But what we could see is that with subsequent passages through humans, for example, within the Menga family, when it was obviously a real killer to Gaspar, and for most of the family members who were at his funeral, it was a real killer. Then they go to the villages. It seems to infect about half the people who directly contacted the sick in the villages in the first round. But by the second round and third round in the villages, which is to say the third or fourth generation of passage through the Menga clan chain of transmission, you had people who actively washed the bodies, who actively took care of the sleeping, dying people. You had children who shared beds with kids that were dying of Ebola, and none of them got the disease.
Now, do you think that this says something about the resistance that people breed internally, or does it say that the virus gets weaker over time?
It has to be the virus. There wasn't enough time for there to be the creation of a large-scale immunity in the population. It was much too rapid. This had to be that the virus itself was adapting to its human host, trying to become less virulent, less deadly.
This could help explain why this outbreak and previous outbreaks were relatively brief.
Yeah, the virus seems to burn itself out.
Now, if the virus can change that quickly, does that mean that it could also change in the opposite direction, hypothetically, and become transmittable through the air, through coughing and sneezing, or become more hardy and therefore have a longer period of the epidemic instead of these short-lived periods that we've seen so far?
Well, of course, that was the premise of the movie Outbreak. They had a fictional virus that was based on Ebola, and they had it, after I think 1 or 2 rounds of transmission through humanity, become an airborne, super transmissible virus. I think that anything in nature might be possible, but you have to first come up with two key things to come up with an answer to your question. The first is, how many genes, how many actual genetic changes would it require for a virus that is confined to fluid-to-fluid transmission to become airborne transmissible? That turns out to be a very complex set, multiple set of genetic changes, not one simple little thing. And therefore, it's pretty hard to imagine that happening quickly. The second thing is, why would it be in the interest of the virus to do that? You have to, I don't want to anthropomorphize. It's not like the virus is sitting around thinking. But there has to be a biological advantage to becoming airborne, because making genetic changes requires expenditures of energy. It requires some concerted effort of some kind. It's not an utterly chance occurrence.
Gee, I think the advantage would be pretty obvious. The virus gets to spread to more people.
Yeah, but if on the contrary, the virus can, with a single gene change, become less virulent and therefore have happy homes for longer periods of time, that's probably an easier way to go.
Is there a fear that maybe what's happening is that the incubation period is lengthening and that some of the people who haven't gotten sick will get sick in 2 years?
I didn't hear that concerned voice by any of the scientists. I think that they see that as fairly unlikely, given just how much of a killer this virus is. It would be a very complex set of genetic changes for a virus to be able to go into a long-term latent state analogous to, say, HIV.
My guest is Lori Garrett, author of the book The Coming Plague. She just returned from 2 weeks in Zaire covering the Ebola epidemic. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Lori Garrett is my guest. Lori, when you were in Zaire, were there restrictions on journalists?
There certainly were. In the beginning, there were a lot of restrictions because the government took advantage of the quarantine situation to try and keep journalists from going into Kikwit. To NPR's credit, Michael Scholar got in there quite early and defied the quarantine order. I personally had a lot of difficulty getting from Kinshasa to Kikwit. But when I did go, I was the only journalist there who had long-term legal permission from the government to be there. Ironically, eventually, all these barriers broke down, and journalists were flying in from all over the world in these hordes that would show up, just horrendous. 20, 30, 40 journalists at once come clamoring into town and then want to have in 4 hours every single visual they can get their hands on, you know, the graveyard, the dying patient, the hospital, the anxious physicians, the anxious research team, then dash back to Kikwit Airport, fly back to Kinshasa, and file it by satellite to your respective news organization. I think one of the big take-home lessons of this epidemic, and I have discussed this extensively with people from both the CDC and WHO, is that we can no longer assume when epidemics occur that the only journalists that are going to come flying in to deal with it are going to be folks like me, medical reporters. It's now very clear the majority of this press corps were the same kind of folks who covered the Persian Gulf War or covered the Rwanda Civil War or what have you. They're crisis journalists. They fly in with their satellite dishes and their whole teams, and they need the visuals, and they need them now. And if they're in the way of your efforts to control the epidemic, well, too bad. They've got another job to do. And the levels of tension and animosity between the scientific team and the journalists were intense, horrendous. There, I actually know of at least two fistfights that broke out between journalists international physicians who came in. And by the time I left, I think everybody had agreed that the fundamental biggest mistake they made was not having a professional press officer on the ground from the very first day to serve as the buffer between the very, very hungry press corps and the very urgently concerned scientific team.
Anything else that the CDC or, what did you say, the CDC and the World Health Organization?
Mm-hmm.
Anything else they decided to do next time around?
Well, I think that everybody saw that the necessary essential supplies and equipment were very slow to arrive. In fact, the bulk of the protective equipment that had been requested from day one of the epidemic for the medical staff, for the Red Cross, and so on, did not arrive until May 27th, when the Swedish government sent in a Hercules jet loaded with the essential equipment. And that's really terrible.
I guess one of the big mysteries remaining now about this outbreak of Ebola is, what is the animal that carries the virus and transmits it to humans? What kind of research is going on now to investigate that question?
That's the most exciting thing about this epidemic, is that we do have what looks like a good source, starting point ecology. And with a limited number of animal species running around, you know, we don't have to now say, well, it could be absolutely any animal in all of the African continent. We can narrow it down. And the scientific team that's working on that was actually quite charged up and excited. They set up a primitive field laboratory inside the old tuberculosis lab at Kikwit General Hospital, put it, with armed guards around it so that people wouldn't go in and contaminate themselves. And in that facility, they worked in whole-body respirator suits that were sweltering and stifling in the heat. But one of the scientists said it was a little bit like being wrapped up in saran wrap all day in the tropics. But obviously, they were having more direct contact with the virus than any of the other scientists, so they needed this protection. And they would go out by night and set traps, and in the morning go out and see what animals they had caught, then bring them back, mash them up, to mash up their livers, mash up their kidneys, study their blood, and try to see if they found Ebola virus. I also went out with some of the scientists who were actively looking for primates that were being kept as pets in Kikwit. It turns out there's quite a business in going to another remote rainforest area, not the area where Gaspar Menga worked, but a different area, about 300 kilometers away, and killing mother chimps or mother gorillas and then taking the babies and bringing them back into Kikwit or into Kinshasa for sale. And so I spent quite a bit of time hunting around Kikwit for these pets. And when I found any, I would tell the scientific team about it. And they, of course, were looking for them as well. And then they would take blood samples to see, were any of these macaques or baby gorillas or baby chimps carrying the Ebola virus? Most of the data on that is not in yet, but it was striking that we didn't find any cases that where there were pet primates and there were also human cases of Ebola. So I think it's pretty safe to say the monkeys were probably not the reservoir of the virus.
And when scientists do find the animal that is carrying Ebola, what options will they have?
Well, let's look at history. In my book, The Coming Plague, I describe other hemorrhagic fever diseases, viruses, where we have, in fact, traced it back to a rodent source. And I mean, it's very interesting that virtually all the hemorrhagic fever viruses do end up tracing to a rodent of some kind. The classic example would be the Machupo outbreak in Bolivia in the 1960s. It eventually turned out that there had been some changes in the local ecology, and as a result of those changes, this town had been overrun by what had been wild mice that suddenly realized that life was a lot easier for the mice. They could get the corn already chopped and piled up for them, just waiting for them. The mouse population flooded into this village, and that mouse population carried this virus that was harmless to most of the mice, but quite deadly to human beings. Once they were able to pinpoint this mouse is the carrier, then it was very easy to control and to prevent future epidemic outbreaks by simply having reasonable rodent control. Amongst the things they did in that particular case was to fly in a lot of pet cats.
You couldn't very well do that in a rainforest, though, could you?
Well, you might not be able to cleanse the rainforest, but you can certainly have the populace understand. Look, you know, put up pictures. This is the carrier of the virus. When you go out into your fields or hunting or whatever, avoid contact with this animal. And if you hunt, don't kill this animal and you know, skin it and so on, because exposure to its blood could be deadly.
Lori, the last time we spoke on Fresh Air, your book, The Coming Plague, had just been published, and you had just gotten back from covering the outbreak of plague in India. Now you've just come back from covering an outbreak of Ebola in Zaire. It's just remarkable. You know, you write this book and all these illnesses are flourishing for you to study. So is it making you awestruck, terrified? What emotion is this leaving you
with?
Well,
you know, when I wrote The Coming Plague, I really secretly hoped that some of my case, of what I was stating, would turn out to be a little extreme, that we weren't really facing as grim a scenario as I was painting. I never could have imagined when I was writing it a year ago at this time, doing the final edit on that book, that pneumonic plague would break out shortly afterwards, that Ebola would return after a 19-year hiatus to Zaire, and that in various parts of the world, antibiotic-resistant old bacterial diseases, but now mutant and different, would emerge and become major killers in totally industrialized, wealthy countries, and that Russia's healthcare would so degenerate that that former superpower, our age-old Cold War enemy, would now be facing huge epidemics of diphtheria, of cholera, of tuberculosis, of measles, of just go down the list. I really thought that I was writing something that was more in the future, more about a scenario for 10 or 15 years from now. And I am thoroughly stunned by the rapidity and the frequency and the severity of what's going on.
Any good thing you want to say before we wrap up?
Well, the good news is that I am experiencing from all over the world a sense of public awareness and heightened concern. I'm getting phone calls and letters from every country you can imagine, from people saying, you're right, we got to get moving on this thing. These emerging infectious disease problems are a global crisis, and we need to approach them as a global community. And my big hope is that this will result in some kinds of effective action, effective strategy, and hopefully even effective spending by the wealthy countries to deal with these crises.
Lori Garrett, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Lori Garrett is the author of The Coming Plague, and she's medical and science writer for Newsday. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have from Bosnia?
Well, we have a report from Tuzla, one of the Bosnian safe areas. A reaction there from people to reports that the UN forces in Bosnia might redeploy. Also, we'll be hearing from Tom Gelton about U.S. policy in Bosnia and a report that the United States now might consider introducing ground troops to try to help redeploy UN forces in Bosnia. Also, John Burnett reports today on Cuba and one of the issues there concerning fragile ecological habitats, whether the Cubans should attempt to exploit the natural beauty of those sites for tourism, and a talk with Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The ongoing debate about pornography and its less hardcore cousins has a new twist. Should sexual material be permitted on the internet? Currently, Congress is considering strict limitations on content in the digital world. Commentator Stephen Levy wonders whether this is a good idea.
Is internet a dirty word? It's certainly true that if you're hooked up with a modem and on the alert for smut, you will find stuff that will raise your eyebrows and test your tolerance. There are pictures of naked women, pictures of naked men, pictures of the Little Mermaid without her halter top. And there are filthy stories, some detailing perverted, even violent sexual acts. There's even the notorious alt.sex.bestiality, an electronic bulletin board where people discuss the kinds of close relationships with animals that the ASPCA never had in mind. It was inevitable that sooner or later the regulators would leap in. And so, Senator James Exon, a Nebraska Democrat, has introduced a legislative measure that would treat all content on the internet as if it were broadcast over the air. It would be illegal to post those nasty pictures. You would also risk fines and imprisonment by writing anything judged indecent. And that includes everything from obscene sexual passages to George Carlin's famous seven dirty words. Sure, a rather small percentage of the mountains of information available on the internet does involve sleazy content. Everything from those graphic tales of bestiality to what I consider the classic example of geek smut, discussions where people describe their fantasies of romantic interludes with various Star Trek characters. But one does not get access to those stories, discussions, and pictures by simply turning on the computer, flipping a channel or two, and seeing what pops up. That's the way TV and radio works, but not computer networks. With the internet, you have to use a rather specific code to locate a particular discussion group or storehouse of files and images. Things don't come at you. You consciously go get them. In that sense, the internet is more like a newsstand or bookstore. It would be absurd to suggest that every book or magazine in the country should be edited to remove anything we wouldn't want a child to see. But that is what the Exxon legislation wants to do to an entire medium. This doesn't mean that sexual content on the internet isn't the problem. When I was a 12-year-old with an intense curiosity about the contents of Playboy magazine, I had to run an impenetrable gauntlet of newsstand owners and drugstore clerks who made sure that my gaze remained on the comic books and not the adult mags. There is no equivalent on the internet, and a reasonably techno-literate preteen can net-surf over to Hugh Hefner's Electronic Cove and download a graphic of Miss April in all her glory. But already, several schemes are in the works to filter out sexual content and network connections made by youngsters, to create sort of a digital recreation of that sharp-eyed clerk. For instance, one approach involves subscribing to a sort of an internet light where requests for hardcore content simply don't compute. And if none of that works, there is always the one measure that censorious legislators always seem to overlook, parental guidance. Instead of letting children run loose in cyberspace, a place very much like the real world, populated by adults good and bad, parents should educate themselves on what's out there and lay down their own law about what's permissible and what's out of bounds. I'm not going to say that these solutions are foolproof, but neither is the First Amendment. Just as some kids have always managed to get their hands on dirty books, or works of art considered dirty by some adults, in the 21st century there will undoubtedly be a few tireless junior net riders hacking their way into the X-rated regions of cyberspace. That's not a new story, and it really isn't a frightening one. Not nearly as scary as boulderizing our communications future.
Stephen Levy is the technology columnist for Newsweek and the author of Insanely Great, The Life and Times of Macintosh, the Computer That Changed Everything. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Roberta Shurrock, with Kathy Wolf and Nancy Updike. Research assistance from Becky Cohen. Kenesha Baker is our intern. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Villard Books, publisher of Rage to Survive, an autobiography of Etta James. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. French parliamentary leaders are supporting their government's emphasis on gaining the release of peacekeepers being held in Bosnia. Lintieri reports from Paris they received a grim briefing today from French President Jacques Chirac.
Prime Minister Alain Juppé told parliamentarians that the situation in Bosnia is bleak and complicated. After the briefing, the leader of the opposition said he agreed with Juppé's priorities, first to get the hostages released, and second, to ensure that the UN troops can protect themselves. Almost half of the nearly 400 peacekeepers being held hostage are French. The politicians did not say what the government plans to do to free the troops. However, a newspaper report said France has sent some elite commando forces to the Adriatic. President Jacques Chirac is also taking a tough line and has ordered French commanders in Bosnia to resist and, if necessary, override UN firing restrictions to avoid being taken captive. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
More British peacekeeping troops are deploying in the Balkans. The first of up to 6,200 British soldiers are now in the Croatian port of Split. They're being followed by mine-clearing equipment and more soldiers. The detachment is part of a force of Western powers growing in the region. U.S. Marines and a French aircraft carrier are moving closer off the Adriatic coast. It's not clear if the added might will be used to fight defiant Serbs. President Clinton is vowing to reject the current revamping of the Clean Water Act. The president says he'll veto the legislation in its current form because it rolls back progress in improving public health.
With all the other changes and challenges the American people have to confront in the world today, they sure should not have to worry about the quality of their water. That is one uncertainty that even in this rapidly changing world, we ought to be able to remove from every family in the United States of America.
But Republicans aren't backing down. The chief House sponsor of the measure says that's nonsense. Republican Representative Bud Schuster of Pennsylvania says Mr. Clinton is reading off the same crude script used by environmental extremists. Negotiators for AT&T and its two unions are back at the bargaining table, still hung up on health care benefits, wage, pension, and union security matters. AT&T spokesman Herb Linen says the issues will take some time to resolve.
You've got parties who have been patient and willing to listen to both sides of the story and are bargaining hard and resourcefully. We're encouraged, and we think the union is working as hard as it can as we are to try and resolve these issues.
Union officials say strike plans are on hold as long as the talks continue to make progress. On Wall Street, the Dow is up more than 8 points at 4,377. The NASDAQ is down almost 13 points. This is NPR News. Three people were killed and at least four are missing after a tornado struck several areas in western Massachusetts last night. Aaron Schachter of member station WFCR has more on the story.
The state and federal emergency management agencies are on the scene surveying the damage to determine if the region should be declared a disaster area. 100 homes and 15 businesses were damaged or destroyed by the tornado, which also caused damage in New York State. The tornado touched down several times in the Berkshire region of Massachusetts before dissipating. Disaster officials are now completing a house-to-house search. Massachusetts Lieutenant Governor Paul Cellucci flew in this afternoon. The Lieutenant Governor would not put a dollar figure on the damage, but said the state would give all that it can. For National Public Radio, I'm Aaron Schachter in Great Barrington, Massachusetts.
The latest measure of consumer confidence shows a decline from last month. The reading for May is 101.6. That's down 3 points from April, but it's still strong. The Conference Board survey finds consumers are less positive in their assessment of current conditions and less optimistic about the months ahead. The Los Angeles Times reports that FBI agents followed farm labor leader Cesar Chavez for more than 7 years in the 1960s and 70s. The Times says Chavez was shadowed during the Johnson and Nixon administration. A large file on the migrant labor leader, more than 1,000 pages, was compiled. The paper obtained a copy of the file under the Freedom of Information Act. Chavez, who died in 1993, led the first successful farm workers union and a national boycott of grapes. Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin is keeping his promise to hold a referendum on peace with Syria. Israeli officials say they're preparing legislation for a vote on the disputed Golan Heights. Syria claims the region as its territory, and Syria warns a vote on a referendum about the Golan Heights would wreak havoc with its negotiations with Israel. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The first detachment of British reinforcements has left for Bosnia. From London, NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports.
An artillery platoon and equipment flew from England this morning to Split on the Croatian coast. At a press conference, Prime Minister John Major said that Britain's 24th Air Mobile Brigade, a rapid response unit comprising 5,000 soldiers, had been put on alert pending developments concerning the 33 British soldiers currently being held hostage by the Bosnian Serbs. Major hinted that the 24th Air Brigade might not serve under the direct control of the United Nations. The Prime Minister also told reporters that he hoped the United Nations would continue its humanitarian role in Bosnia, but he acknowledged that the time might come when the UN had to withdraw. If it did, he warned the Bosnian Serbs not to expect the European powers to walk away. He said containing the war in Bosnia was in Europe's strategic interests. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
A top Russian official says the earthquake damage in Sakhalin highlights the thoughtlessness of Soviet officials who built high-rise buildings in quake-prone areas. As NPR's Jan Gerolds reports, the devastation following Sunday's quake has people in other areas concerned.
Barely a building survived the earthquake. The town of Neftegorsk is not to be rebuilt. But Russian seismologists say other disasters are waiting to happen because of poor construction and the likelihood of still greater tremors in the Russian Far East. Alexander Sidorin, head of the seismology lab at the Russian Institute of Physics, predicts a quake will hit the far eastern peninsula of Kamchatka within 3 years. Before it's too late, he urges the buildings in the capital, a city of 300,000, be strengthened. Sunday's quake has also renewed fears of what scientists call the inevitable tremor in the former Republic of Kazakhstan, which borders China. While there are no signs of an imminent quake, seismologists there are also taking this opportunity to raise concerns. I'm Ann Gerrels in Moscow.
President Clinton has threatened to veto a Republican overhaul of the Clean Water Act. The bill changes federal protection of waterways from urban, industrial, and farmland pollution. Supporters of the revised bill say the 1972 law is too expensive for industry and local governments and is unfair to property owners. President Clinton says Republicans worked with industry lobbyists to rewrite the act. He accuses the GOP of inviting lobbyists into the back rooms of Congress to write loopholes for their industries. Rescue workers in Massachusetts are looking for more victims from a tornado in southern Berkshire County. 3 people died and at least 4 people are missing. The twister swept a path 20 miles long. A police helicopter is helping assess damage, now estimated in the millions of dollars. On Wall Street, stock prices were up today. The Dow rose 9.5 points to close at 4,378. This is NPR. The South Korean news agency reports 2 crew members aboard a South Korean trawler were killed and another was wounded today when their boat came under fire after entering territorial waters claimed by North Korea. From Tokyo, NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
North Korea said it seized the fishing boat when it illegally intruded into waters off its western coast. It was reportedly the second time in 4 days that the trawler had been stopped. On Saturday, officials in China seized it for allegedly violating its territorial waters and illegally fishing. There is no independent confirmation that the ship's crew members were killed today when the ship was fired on by a North Korean patrol. The Central News Agency claims the crew ignored warnings to stop before shots were fired. The seizure of the South Korean ship is certain to heighten tensions on the Korean Peninsula. The normal strains have been intensified in recent weeks over a dispute on how best to implement an agreement that would keep nuclear weapons out of the hands of the North. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
The numbers of Ebola virus cases and deaths have risen in Zaire. The World Health Organization says it's found 205 cases and 153 deaths. That's up from yesterday's figure of 160 cases and 122 deaths. But the United Nations agency says the sharp increase is because of updated reports from villages, not because of a surge in new infections. Japan is pushing the United States to renew auto talks before a major trade summit next month. Japan's trade minister says he'll send a letter to the U.S. Trade Representative Mickey Cantor. Japan wants to open consultations June 15th in Geneva. The United States wants talks to start on June 20th, just 8 days before U.S. import tariffs are to be imposed on Japanese luxury cars. Both countries have appealed to the new World Trade Organization for help in their car dispute. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.